What has the feeling been like on Guam over the past few weeks in the wake of these threats from North Korea?
You know, I would say that locally, we kind of have a mixed reaction. On the one hand, we're told by our governor, we're told by the U.S. federal government, Department of Defense, you don't have to worry. We have the technology. If there were any missile strikes, we'll be able to strike it down. And so we don't have to worry. But at the same time, you know, there's sort of this counter narrative that really is the more natural narrative that runs in our head. And it's the one that reminds us that of our historical trauma. So in during the time of World War II, between the years of 1941 and 1944, our island, Guam, was the only place that was invaded by the Japanese during that time period that was U.S. soil. So we are, you know, our ancestors, many of our elders have experienced very actively war during that time period and the atrocities of war that were committed against our people, massive suffering and so forth. So that is actually just a footstep away. And while war today looks very different from war as it looked during the 1940s, that still is pretty traumatizing, really, when we start to allow ourselves to imagine the possibility that this attack may happen. In light of this reality, we also are, you know, when we connect the dots in terms of the militarization of our island, how it's connected to our colonial status, then we start to really get angry because this is a very unfair, undemocratic system in which we live.
Indeed. And as you mentioned, Guam is a key military posting for the United States. There's a massive, massive military presence there. You're from the Guam Coalition for Peace and Justice. What does that organization fight for and how hard is that struggle?
Currently, we already have our island occupied one third by the U.S. Department of Defense. So depending on which particles of land you count, it's between 29% and 33% that's quoted as the DOD's footprint here. So basically and essentially, we are already a hyper-militarized community. We're the highest, number one in the country, in the United States, of enlistment rates per capita in the U.S. Department of Defense. You know, everywhere you look around here, a journalist from the Washington Post said in one of his articles, you know, that people on Guam wake up with war ringing in their ears. And he's right in some ways. You know, so we're already a hyper-militarized community. And when we heard of this transfer that was being planned, you know, from the accord that was signed in 2006, women really became very, very deeply concerned about this and learned a lot more about what militarization is and its impacts on communities. And we realized that we really are the poster child of those impacts, you know, from negative health outcomes to the land dispossession to the deferral of our self-government, you know, the deferral of our rights to self-determination. I mean, the list just goes on and on in terms of how we've been paying the price for the United States' military posturing, particularly in the Asia-Pacific region. And so a bunch of us got together literally in somebody's kitchen, and week to week we started talking and said, this is unacceptable, we really need to do something. And so we started initially with doing public fora in our community, and since then with our primary focus on demilitarization as well as decolonization. And so that's why we came up with that as the organizational name, the Guam Coalition for Peace and for Justice, because both really are very intertwined in many of the issues that impact us here on our island.
Definitely. Now, for over 100 years, Guam has remained under U.S. jurisdiction, but even to this day, you on the island are not eligible to vote for the American president or even to select members of Congress with voting power. That must be really frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, when you start to wrap your mind around that, I mean, you know, for us, it's a reality, right? It's always been our reality. So in some ways, we're rather desensitized to what colonization brings. There's not even a collective questioning of that until more recently and of late, largely because of a big fueling funneled through the university wherein, you know, we're creating these opportunities for dissecting the deeper questions about our political status and the military's presence here. But yeah, I mean, our colonial status not only means that we do not have the right to vote for the U.S. president, it also means that we have one elected delegate. We elect a delegate to the U.S. Congress who sits in the House of Representatives. However, she does not have the opportunity to vote on issues that are on the floor. So essentially, it really is such a blatant example of creating this illusion of participation in the U.S. political system you know, in democracy, when in fact it isn't. And so that's why I often refer to Guam as America's best kept secret, because while, you know, its agenda globally, right, in terms of its massive numbers of foreign military or U.S. Department of Defense military bases in foreign countries, including Australia, there is no democracy here on Guam. You know, and those two things I mentioned are just skimming the surface in terms of what being a territory means, right? So we don't vote for president. We have limited participation in U.S. Congress. In addition to that, we get roughly 1/7 the funding that's available to U.S. states. So economically, the infusion is very, very limited. With that, we get occupation of our land, 1/3 of our land, prime real estate in terms of geographical location on the globe. We have the deferral of our rights to self-determination. Guam is the largest landmass in all of Micronesia. Yet, in what was referred to as the American Pacific, which are all the American colonies, only Guam has been denied the opportunity to decolonize. All our neighboring islands, smaller than we are, have had the opportunity to decolonize and exercise some form of self-government. We've never had that opportunity, and it's not that we haven't tried. I mean, we did submit a draft act to U.S. Congress. For the most part, it sat relatively idle for about 20 years. And then, you know, finally in a hearing in 97, they basically said, sorry, we're not going to accept this. So the old school form of colonization continues to exist in the world, and certainly for us on Guam.
So in terms of decolonization, there are often three paths forward given as options for Guam's political future: independence, free association with the U.S., or full integration as a new American state. Which do you support and why?
Well, I definitely don't support statehood, largely because it's clear that the relationship we have with the United States is not a benevolent one, and it's not a relationship of love. So for that reason alone, fundamentally, I do not support statehood. That being said, I think the other two options are great options. Of course, the gold standard would be that of independence, full independence. But I think what I want to underscore as a member of the Commission on Decolonization is that every single Chamorro, as defined by our public law, has the right to participate in this vote and should exercise that right to determine our political future. So whatever the outcome of that vote is, that's how we move forward in terms of implementing, because, you know, and through that process of the plebiscite, the people would have spoken.
So with all that in mind, and as you mentioned before, you're hoping for a plebiscite on decolonization next year. How optimistic are you for the future of Guam?
You know, we are only limited by our imaginations. We can choose to be pessimistic if we look at other developing third world countries. We can choose to be optimistic looking at those who've done really well for themselves. You know, you look at Singapore and how Singapore in a decade turned its economic situation from very bad to very good. You know, so we're very motivated by the idea that for once, we can use our imaginations and create a reality for ourselves here, you know, using our ingenuity and forging relationships with people around us and far away, you know, to be able to develop an economy that will work for us. You know, we're in constant consultation with Dr. Carlisle Corbin, who's an international expert on governance and on decolonization. You know, one of the greatest fears is, oh no, we've traveled into the Pacific. Are we going to become like that? And his response, very calmly, every single time, is your life will probably not change very much for at least the first 100 years after you decolonize, you know? And he says that because we already have an economic base. And if our current relationship with the U.S. is such that limits that, then when those limitations are taken away, then it will enhance our ability to increase our economic activities. In terms of what independence could look like, I mean, I think I choose to dream wildly and to be passionate and be working hard towards, you know, the coming to fruition, but at the same time not being naive to think that it wouldn't take at least a decade. You know, a decade to me is not that long a period of time if that's, you know, if that's what we need to set ourselves on our course so that we are become self-sufficient and we become self-governing, because this colonial reality that we're living in right now is killing us, literally. It's like genocide of our people.
Indeed. Lisa, it's been great to talk to you. Good luck for the future, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate your taking the time to get to understand our story a little better.